Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and we have a fantastic show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking with Jenny Brown, the founder and director of Family Services Institute in Sydney. She's written a book, it's called Who's Willing to Work at Growing Up? And we're going to be talking about that in the first half of the show. In the second half of the show, we're going to be doing some research into finding out if calcium is good for you and what you should know about that. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
Nearly one in three people may battle alcohol use disorder in their lifetime, according to a new study. Alcohol use disorder is defined as problem drinking that includes symptoms such as craving alcohol, taking in larger amounts than was intended, or having a persistent desire or history of unsuccessful efforts to cut down. Researchers conducted face-to-face interviews with more than 36,000 adults, asking about alcohol habits over the prior 12 months and over their lifetime. The lifetime prevalence of alcohol use disorder was 29.1%, but fewer than one in five sought treatment. The authors say these findings highlight the urgency of educating the public and policymakers about alcohol use disorder and its treatments, destigmatizing the disorder, and encouraging those who cannot reduce their alcohol consumption on their own, despite substantial harm to themselves and others, to seek treatment. Experts say more motorcyclists are taking to U.S. roads, increasing the need for safety precautions. 48% more motorcycles rolled down American highways in 2007 than in 1998. And according to the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, about 2.3 million motorcycle injuries were reported in 2013. The American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and Orthopedic Trauma Association warns both riders and car drivers need to take steps to reduce the risk of motorcycle crashes. Among the safety tips they suggest, if you're distracted while driving a car, pull over in a safe area and deal with the matter. New motorcyclists should take a safety training course, and experienced riders should take refresher courses, and always wear an approved helmet that fits securely to your head shape and size, protects the face, and has adequate ventilation to keep you cool and reduce visor fogging. A recent study suggests air pollution exposure may be linked to a child's risk of autism. The controversial findings echo similar results from a study last winter that found an increased risk of autism among children of women exposed to more smog late in pregnancy. This new study, which does not establish a direct connection between dirty air and autism, did not find a statistically significant increased risk for autism related to air pollution exposure at any specific time during pregnancy. Instead, the authors found a child's odds of autism were 1.5 times greater when air pollution exposure was greater across the entire span of time from pre-pregnancy until the child was 2 years old. The findings were published in the July issue of the journal Environmental Research. And finally, having acknowledged that the 2014-15 flu vaccine was mismatched to the circulating influenza strains, U.S. health officials have ramped up next season's shots for broader protection. Flu vaccine makeup is determined months in advance, so manufacturers have time to make the millions of doses needed. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says in its June 5th Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that components of the coming 2015-16 season vaccine have been changed to more optimally match circulating viruses. CDC epidemiologist Lynette Brammer says last year no one saw until summer that the H3N3 strain would be predominant, adding work on the vaccine had begun in February.
Well, thanks for that, Reg. Well, our first guest that we're expecting is Jenny Brown. She's the founder and director of Family Services Institute in Sydney, Australia, where she is a counseling practice and trains mental health professionals and organizations. She's won a number of awards and has a number of postgraduate degrees, but she's written a book called Growing Yourself Up. And and we're just waiting for her to come on the show, but I'll tell you a little bit about the book just to start with. She's from Australia, and so that's why the little bit of delay. We're not sure if she was unsure of the time difference. In her book, which is quite interesting, she talks about understanding relationships and how we need to do that to really become mature and using that maturity to make a difference in our life. So what she's saying is that a lot of people are not willing to grow up, and that that relationships don't happen on their own, that they do take a lot of work. And her research is showing that we can make some significant differences in our lives by working on certain aspects of this. But it seems like we're not even going to be able to get her on the line, so we're going to just go right ahead with our interview with Lucy Amrafor, which we talked to a few weeks ago, and go ahead with that. Our first guest, Lucy Amrafor, is a PhD and a registered dietitian. She's co-authored a book called Body Respect, what conventional health books get wrong, leave out, and just plain fail to understand about weight. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave.
So let's start out by talking a little bit about, you know, the research you've done in this area and how you first got interested in it.
Okay, thanks. So I was first interested when I was working as a dietitian, and I saw very early on that the people that came to me, mostly for help around weight loss, weren't actually any healthier, it seemed, or any happier for, you know, for their efforts. And people would often tell me that they felt lazy or they were a failure. And in fact, when I listened to their stories, people had invested the whole of their adult lives in trying to diet. So I began to look into the research. I couldn't work out what it was that I was doing wrong. And what I found was that what I'd been telling my clients, you know, just eat less and exercise more, believing in good faith that that was going to lead to a pretty sort of predictable rate of weight loss, actually wasn't borne out by the research data. So that was a pretty alarming thing, really. And also, when I looked further into the research, I began to realise that people could improve their health by making lifestyle change, whether or not their weight, in fact, changed. So I began to recognise that I needed to shift my focus from the focus on weight onto the focus on eating well for the sake of eating well and being more active for the sake of being more active. And it's not so much that I was against weight loss, but I was certainly against the pursuit of weight loss. And then there was two more things as well that were really, really significant in sort of changing my direction. One of them was the fact that so many people were so distressed, and rightly so, about the treatment that they'd received because of their weight, how they'd been devalued or insulted, both in and beyond healthcare, and the enormous courage it took for people with these experiences to come and see another healthcare practitioner. So I saw that whatever approach I was using, it had to explicitly address both size discrimination and also the enormous amounts of body shame that people felt. And then lastly, the last key factor was that it struck me that the areas that I was working in, there was a lot of deprivation, and it seemed that surely people's diet couldn't be the be-all and end-all when it came to health. And in fact, one day I was in a meeting in the department, and we were talking about high rates of heart disease in South Asian men in the city that I work, the city of Coventry. It's got the dubious accolade of being the furthest that you can get from the sea in England. And it had previously been the centre of the car trade, and when the car industry closed down, there was a lot of deprivation. And anyway, so we were talking about heart disease in South Asian men, which is double that of the rate in the general population. And we spoke about what you might think of all the usual culprits, ghee, smoking, sedentary behaviour. And it seemed to me that what changed most when people moved, say, from Mumbai to England was racism. And yet there was nowhere in the conversation for the potential impact of racism, I didn't know at this stage, but for the potential impact of racism on heart disease to be discussed. So when I left the meeting, I went and I researched it, and sure enough, I found that there's a wealth of literature showing that oppression, such as racism, such as homophobia, and also the stress of living with chronic poverty, independently impact on metabolic health. So the things that I was interested in as a dietitian, such as blood pressure and heart health, that they independently influence that, even if somehow somebody manages to eat well and keep active. So really, that was the sort of four key strands that set me researching another approach. And that's the approach that Linda and I describe in the book.
You know, you touch on some really interesting topics that, you know, like you say in the front of your book, that you know, that other books don't really talk about. And it's interesting that you're looking at the relationship between depression, racism, and not only heart disease but weight gain. What is that relationship directly?
The thing that I think the thing that's interesting is that very often weight gain is seen as a negative thing. But of course, it's not necessarily. So I think what we need to do is sort of step back and the metabolic pathway, if we're going to sort of single out one route for the metabolic pathway, it would be the hormone would be through cortisol.
Right.
So people who live with chronic stress have higher levels of high cortisol for longer than people who don't live with chronic stress, who when something stressful happens, the cortisol level and the other pathways that triggers will, the cortisol will raise and the pathways will come into operation. But then when the acute stress has passed, we go back into our ordinary state, known as homeostasis. But for people where there is increased levels of circulating cortisol and a lot of stress, we can't go back into homeostasis and remain in a state called allostasis, which is sort of a long-term adaptation to living with stress. And it's that influences our metabolism.
You know, it's interesting that you're talking about that relationship, because there has been some studies that have linked cortisol levels to and stress levels to weight gain. But how do we get beyond that? You know, how do we get to losing that? Is it just a matter of chilling out?
That's a great question. And I mean, the good news is that there's two things. That number one, it puts social determinants of health into the health equation. And that's really important, because ultimately it means that if we want healthy societies, we have to build fair societies. So it puts equality and respect center stage in the health conversation. And also, it doesn't mean, just because we can see discrepancies within groups, it doesn't mean that if somebody has had difficult life circumstances to start with, or is experiencing a lot of stress, that they are necessarily hurtling along the trajectory that they can do nothing about. And so on the one hand, we need to acknowledge social structures. On the other hand, we can work with people to help them become more resilient within difficult lives, and also seek to tackle the structural factors that are influencing them.
Okay, I want to come back to that after, but tell us a little bit about what are some of the facts and the fiction that surround weight gain.
Okay, where to start with this one? So I think one of them is that the idea that you have to be thin to be healthy. And of course, some thin people are healthy and so are some fatter people, and vice versa. So I think we need to knock that one on the head to start with, because if we begin to explore that one, then it makes dieting futile in the first place. Another one is that a very strong idea that this idea that people can and should be thin, and that you can achieve this just by spending more calories, burning off more calories than you eat. Now, we know this is fundamental to all the sort of lifestyle weight change programs. And whereas it holds true in the short term, everybody will know people who've lost weight in a week, in 4 weeks. So short-term weight loss is almost inevitable. But in the same way that we've got regulatory systems for temperature, for blood gases, for blood pH, we also have regulatory systems for body fat that work in the long term. So this means that when we try and reduce our calorie intake, sure, we'll lose weight in the short term, but our homeostatic body fat regulation mechanism kicks in, and this works to push our push us back to our set point. So we've all got a settling point that's pretty much genetically programmed. And we know this from the largest and longest study in the area, that was the Women's Health Initiative. So this was about 20,000 women followed for 8 years. And at the end of 8 years, the women in the control group, in the experimental group, were having about 360 calories less per day and exercising more, and their weight had pretty much stayed the same. And in the control group, rather than seeing weight gain, which is what we're often told, if we don't do anything, people are going to just carry on gaining weight, their weight has stayed the same as well. The idea that you just add willpower to calorie deficit and you'll lose weight is not borne out by the evidence.
You mentioned that, you know, that we're genetically programmed. So if our, you know, if our family is, you know, comes from perhaps a Eastern European background where they're, you know, traditionally, you know, big bones or a little heavier, is there any chance of us ever being skinny? You know, really, are we wasting our time trying to be skinny if that's the genetic predisposition that we have?
So whatever our set point and the genetic predisposition, if we're certainly, we're not only wasting our time trying to fight it, but we're actually doing harm trying to fight it. So it's true that that our ethnicity is one of the factors that is going to influence our set point. And there's other things as well, for instance. So if a mother is very malnourished or undernourished when she's carrying the baby as a fetus, that child is more likely to be heavier than it would otherwise have been as an adult. So, in other words, be above what its set point would have been. And moreover, that in itself, it seems, isn't the issue. Moreover, to have related health problems. When I say related, I don't mean related to the weight, but related to the metabolic dysfunction. So we can see from this that any moves to weight loss in pregnant women are, you know, really a cause for concern.
We're talking with Lucy Aframore, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be finding out more about body respect and what you can do to live your optimum weight.